Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, severe weather across the South makes its way to our region, leading to two deaths, property damage, and thousands out of power. Charlotte City Manager proposes a property tax increase. Memorials for four fallen officers continue. Protests at UNC Charlotte over the war in Gaza continue even after tents are removed. While in Chapel Hill, some students call for professors to withhold grades until administrators grant amnesty to pro-Palestinian protesters. And the trial that may determine the fate of voter ID in our state gets underway in Winston-Salem. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Mary Ramsey is here, a local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner is WBTV's chief investigative reporter. And Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV and host of The Political Beat on Sunday mornings. Good morning to you all. Welcome.
Morning.
Morning.
So severe weather has been plaguing the South and much of the Midwest for this entire week. We've had scads of tornadoes, drenching rains causing major damage and flooding. We got a taste of that on Wednesday. It resulted in falling trees, power outages, two deaths. What do we know about what happened in Gaston County? They seem to have gotten, Gaston, Lincoln, and Cleveland seem to have gotten the brunt of it all. Eli.
Yeah, there were two tornadoes that went through that area. We know that an EF1 tornado hit Cleveland and Gaston counties on Wednesday, and then a second EF1 was confirmed to hit Gaston County as well. But even more than just those tornadoes, there were heavy winds and severe thunderstorms in Charlotte as well. And while thankfully nobody in Charlotte died, there was still significant property damage, especially in Uptown and the neighborhoods surrounding it.
Yeah, the property damage elsewhere in the South and through the Midwest it's astronomical. I mean, 9 inches of rain fell, I think, in an hour someplace, and it caused major flooding. And there was a period during this storm here where Gaston County declared a state of emergency. Why did they do that?
That was at a point when tens of thousands of people were without power. It allowed them to open shelters, and it also helps out with different aid programs in the future.
People are still out of power this morning, and as a WFAE News reports, they should all have that power restored sometime by noon today, today being Friday. Just under 2 weeks ago, law enforcement officers were killed, four of them, four others wounded at a shootout in East Charlotte, as we all know, where officers were attempting to serve a warrant. One of those officers, CMPD's Joshua Iyer, was laid to rest last Friday. And when Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles was on this program on Wednesday, she spoke of attending the funerals and the various memorial services for these officers.
I hope that people know that our law enforcement team, they're doing so much to make sure that the fallen heroes' families are being cared for. And this community has done nothing except make it possible for us to grieve, but also to support the family and to support our officers. It is something that's at the front of your mind all the time. How do you know, and how do these officers continue to run forward and protect us to make us all safer?
One of those officers had his funeral yesterday, Alden Elliott with the North Carolina Department of Corrections. And on Monday, a memorial service was held at Bojangles Coliseum for Deputy U.S. Marshal Thomas Weeks Jr. Several people spoke at that, including the Attorney General, Merrick Garland. Is it unusual for the Attorney General to attend these kinds of events?
You know, I think this is a really unusual shooting and mass shooting just in terms of the number of law enforcement officers who were shot and killed. As we've said, this is one of the worst incidents for law enforcement officers being shot, and one of the highest death tolls, unfortunately, in recent history. And, you know, it's actually, like, we all remember Waco. Four officers died on the first day of Waco. Four officers died here in Charlotte. So I think that plus the five more who were injured is why, you know, this was just that significant an event.
Yeah, Merrick Garland said that Thomas Weeks, whom he referred to as Tommy, quote, had developed a reputation for being the kind of law enforcement officer and friend you could count on. No matter what he was doing, he gave everything he had. And as we said, as Eli just said, he died in doing his job on the deadliest day for law enforcement in this city, at least, since 2007. City Manager Marcus Jones has his hands full. He's put together his proposed budget. He presented it to City Council this week. And while he was talking about the budget with WBTV, Councilman Tariq Bakari interrupted that interview.
Hey, buddy, we got a lot to talk about with this budget coming up here.
I look forward to it.
Can't wait.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if that exchange happened before or after the presentation of the budget, but one thing appears certain from the presentation: property taxes will soon rise if this budget is passed. Mary, I know you are covering this like white on rice, so tell me how much we're talking about here.
Yes, so we are talking about a 1.5 cent proposed property tax increase. The city says that will average out for the typical homeowner to about another dollar a week or about $54 a year on your property tax bill. This is technically the first proposed property tax increase in about 5 years. However, I think it's worth noting that while the city went with a quote-unquote revenue neutral rate in last year's budget, about 90% of Charlotte homeowners still saw a bigger property tax bill because of property value increases during revaluation.
And when we talk about average homeowners, what are we talking about? What's the average? Where's the median price that gives us a dollar a week for this tax?
That is based, the city has said, on the median home price here in Charlotte, which, if memory serves, they put at about $350,000.
Okay. So Marcus Jones did, in fact, warn last year when council kept taxes revenue neutral following that revaluation, that storm clouds would be gathering. And he told us on this program on Wednesday that over the years, the city has been making cuts, but you can only do that for so long before you have to start looking at revenues.
Over the last 6 years, we've cut about $40 million out of this budget. And I begin to become concerned about the delivery of services, anything from 911 calls, response times, to fire inspections. So it came a point where we need to make sure that we're providing a level of service to our residents that they can support.
But it's not just about maintaining services. It's about pay raises and it's about rising costs, which we're all experiencing, but then so is government. So talk about that. I mean, police and firefighters are scheduled to get a pay increase.
Yes. So the way that Marcus has broken down that 1.5 cent is that about 9/10 of it will be going into the city's general fund, primarily for public safety needs. Public safety proposals within the budget include, like you said, raises for CMPD and Charlotte Fire, as well as some 911 call center investments and some new fire stations throughout the city. And on top of that, he's also interested in putting some of that new revenue into arts. We've had a lot of drama in the last few years here in Charlotte with arts funding. The city says they're trying to finally put together a new plan that would pump about $11 million in funding into the arts. So a lot of it, we're told, will be going into the public safety side of things, but there are some other things as well that this tax increase would be funding.
I want to come back to that arts component in a moment. Eli?
Yeah, and I think, the city has put a really big emphasis on the lowest paid workers over the past few years. The hourly workers who, you know, pick up our trash and maintain our streets. Marcus Jones has proposed a 5% raise for hourly employees, but the lowest paid would get about a $3,200 raise. So it would be weighted towards them. And I think one stat in particular really illustrates why the city is looking to raise taxes. 8 years ago, the lowest paid hourly employees in Charlotte made about $13.78 an hour. This year, coming year under Marcus Jones' proposed budget, that would go up to $23 an hour. It's been rising that whole time, but you're talking going from $13 an hour to $23 an hour. Now, you know, I think the people who pick up our trash and fix our streets deserve every penny of that. They certainly work harder than I do. But when you think about the city raising wages to that degree, it's kind of amazing they haven't done a property tax increase already. There's really, I don't think, any way you can near double those salaries without raising revenue.
And when you raise salaries, you have to also consider raising benefits. And the city is facing the same thing that the education industry and probably all industries are facing, and that is the need to attract and retain employees. And if you underpay them, they exit. And this is an attempt to stave off some of that. Jones told us on this program that the need for a property tax increase is also about dealing with growth and making sure that public safety is being adequately funded.
One of the things that I thought was important based on council input is that how do we make sure that we're able to keep up with this growth? And what you'll see in this budget, that tax increase, 9/10 of that cent is really around public safety. And I think that's important. The last time we raised taxes almost 6 years ago, a penny, the vast majority of that, 75% of that was for public safety. So we want to take care of folks. We want to take care of our officers, our employees. And the rest of the increase is essentially half of that is related to our capital investment plan, infrastructure. And the other half is related to arts and culture.
Which brings us back to what you were just talking about, Mary. It also happens that he's earmarked, as you said, $11 million for the arts. And that happens to be, by happenstance, the exact figure that the Foundation for the Carolinas and the Arts and Science Council have proposed the city kick in to their new cooperative effort. They want $10 million from the county. The city, and I tried to get a straight answer out of it. You just can't get a straight answer. The city had already set up its own mechanism to do this and had kind of distanced themselves from the Arts and Science Council a couple of years ago. But I was told that now that organization, for which they hired a director, is sunsetting. So are they on board with the Foundation for the Carolinas? Is this money going into that pot of money with the $10 million from the county, and will the ASC be back in charge?
So Marcus Jones did not specifically reference this new proposal in his budget presentation. That proposal first came to life.
Why can't we get a straight answer about this? Seriously.
I did, when the Foundation for the Carolinas and the ASC made this pitch to the Mecklenburg County Commission a few weeks ago, I did reach out to the city and say, hey, are you guys on board with this? And they basically said, as you just said, Mike, we've sort of been figuring out our own game plan. We passed this big arts and culture plan last year. We're figuring out our own setting. We're committed to funding the arts broadly. Flash forward a few weeks to the budget, and you see this $11 million. They said about $9 million of that would go towards some more of the more traditional, well-established arts organizations and venues in Charlotte. And an additional $2 million would go into more like individual grants for artists. But as you said, very similar amount to what the ASC and the Foundation for the Carolinas were hoping to get.
Not only is it very similar, it is exact. It just seems coinky-dinky to me. Following the budget presentation, Mayor Lyles mentioned that the council would have a lot to consider in the coming weeks.
We really need to take some time to read, absorb, review, inquire.
And Council's Marjorie Molina seemed resigned to the realities that necessitated this budget proposal.
The truth of the matter is that the cost to run this city, the cost to live has increased substantially.
So what was the reaction of most of council? Mary.
Yeah, we didn't really get any council discussion at the actual budget proposal. So not a lot of council members have really made their views known yet. We will have the budget public hearing at Monday's city council meeting, a time during which the council will hear from members of the community, collect their thoughts on the budget proposal, and we'll have a number of meetings in the coming weeks to hear what they have to say.
I guess that's where we'll get citizen reaction. There's more to talk about with the budget, just a little bit, and we'll cover that, fees, etc., and campus protests, which continue around the country and here as well, in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Senior WFAE News Editor Eli Portillo is with us, along with Nick Oxner from WBTV, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, and Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. And Joe, as part of this budget proposal, Marcus Jones, the city manager, is recommending a $400 million bond referendum package, $100 million of which would fund the city's Affordable Housing Trust Fund. That's double the size of the value of previous bond packages for affordable housing. What else would these bonds fund?
So there's also a very significant transportation bond as well that will be on about $238 million. Which is a significant chunk of money that will help them hit some of their Vision Zero goals. It's nowhere what they need to, say, expand a light rail or, you know, put in bus rapid transit, some of the other goals that they have, extending the streetcar. But it is a good step. City of Charlotte voters have indicated in the past there really hasn't been much opposition to these bonds. So they have good success with getting voters to buy into them. And I believe part of the tax increase might have given them the ability to go this high. But significant amounts of money will be on the ballot.
Yeah, saying yes to these bonds, it should be noted, in November will not increase your taxes. Unlike the school bond that we had just a few months ago, the $2.5 billion bond, which will increase your county taxes, this will not, because it's built into the budget request that he's already come forward with to Charlotte right. City Council. And we talked a little bit about this with Marcus Jones this week. And one of the things that he bragged about was Charlotte's tax rate being lower than 12 other North Carolina cities, and the fact that we haven't had to raise taxes for 5 years.
So when you start to think about property tax, water, stormwater, solid waste, the cost of service, Charlotte is about $1,500 less than the next large city in North Carolina. That would be Raleigh. So I think there's good value there. And you're right, over the last 5 years, Greensboro has raised taxes three times, Winston-Salem four times, Durham three times, Raleigh three times. And they are anywhere from 1.7 times our rate to almost 2.5 times our rate. We are by far the lowest tax rate of large cities in North Carolina. I feel like we are in good company with having to address big city issues and the revenue sources, which are so limited to them, to use those to address the big city issues.
So he did mention these things, these water and sewer things, which are fees. And those fees, Mary, are also probably going to rise. Solid waste removal, by how much?
The solid waste fee increase, I believe, is less than a dollar a month. The Charlotte water increase would be closer to about $4.50 a month, if memory serves. And then stormwater was also less than a dollar, I believe, a month.
Eli.
And I think it's worth putting in context the broader picture that, you know, as you mentioned, taxes are going to go up to pay for the school bonds that were authorized. The county manager is also presenting her budget proposal next week. And county property taxes, which is about two-thirds of your property tax bill, I think are very likely to go up to cover their increased costs as well. So, you know, you've got city fees, city taxes, county taxes. On their own, none of them, you know, are probably going to break the bank, as Mary said, $54 a month for the average median house in Charlotte. But this is a year on top of the recent revaluation where, you know, everyone is going to be seeing a bigger tax bill going forward. And, you know, to what Marcus Jones said about the other 12, you know, cities that haven't raised or have higher taxes, there's a different dynamic in Charlotte, which is we are right on the border with South Carolina with lower taxes. And, you know, the Triangle cities don't have to really consider that cross-border flight, too.
Right. Well, for weeks, college campuses have been the scene of protests over the war in Gaza, and this is what it sounded like earlier this week at UNC Charlotte.
Gaza, Gaza, don't you cry!
The whole world is on your side!
The whole world is on your side!
A few dozen protesters marching on the UNC Charlotte campus after university officials removed several tents and warned protesters against marching. One student protester there, who did not want to give their name, said that the group decided to march to show that they would not be deterred by the university removing their belongings.
We are not afraid of what the university is trying to do. We are not going to accept their fear and their intimidation tactics. We are going to continue to show up and show that even if they take down our tents, it does not mean that we will stop fighting. Our tents are merely symbolic, but our fight continues every single day.
So, Joe, you were there on campus for part of this. Why were the tents removed, and why did the university warn against marching at the university?
So tents were removed because the university says that they warned the protesters this is in violation of university property. They came out with a statement last night saying once the tents were removed, they found knives and baseball-sized rocks and other things that were in the tents. They didn't produce any photos of them. We did request to see what exactly they claim to have seized, but they said it basically violates university policy. And in terms of the march, so it's finals week in UNC Charlotte right now at UNC Charlotte. And apparently they really warned against doing a march throughout campus like they did. Roads had to be shut down on campus. And in the middle of the march, one of the student organizers pulled out her phone and said, "I just got an email saying I have been suspended." So they really took this seriously. We don't have numbers of how many people were actually impacted by this.
Well, that was my next question. If they warn you not to do it and you do it, what are the penalties? And you just gave an example of that. How did they identify that person and then email her or him?
You know, I know that the organizers of the UNCC encampment have been regularly meeting with administration officials to kind of talk about some of the things that they would like. So I think the university has an idea of at least some of the people who are in charge of this.
And at many universities around the country, following arrest, it was discovered that a large number of protesters at these various campuses were not affiliated with the schools at which they were protesting. I think at Columbia University, of all the arrests, 50% were not affiliated with the university. Do we know what that number here is, or what that number in Chapel Hill is?
No, I don't. I know that one of the organizers that I interviewed during the protest said she was a graduate, so she wasn't a student of UNC Charlotte. So not everybody involved is a student, but I don't know exactly how many.
Meanwhile, Republicans in the state Senate want to crack down on one aspect of these protests. Some of those participating here and around the country are wearing masks, the kinds of masks that we wore during COVID. Some are wearing them to mask their identities, obviously. State Senator Buck Newton from Wilson County presented a bill to make wearing masks illegal.
It also creates an enhancement of punishment if the defendant, the accused, wears a mask to conceal their identity during the commission of another crime.
His bill is called Unmasking Mobs and Criminals. It would repeal a law passed during COVID that allowed for masks in public for health and safety reasons, which overrode a 1953 law banning any mask, hood, or device that would conceal a person's identity, which was put into place in response to Ku Klux Klan activity back in the early 50s. Is this bill going to pass in this short session? Any guesses?
Who can say? And that's not to be glib, but, you know, we should remember as the bill filing deadline approaches in the short session, any lawmaker can file any bill saying anything crazy, normal, not crazy, needed. But because it's a short session, lawmakers don't want to do a whole lot, right, by design. And so, you know, it could easily clear the Senate, but be dead in the House. And yeah. It's too early to say on that. So who knows?
Eli.
One thing that I think is interesting with this bill to note is that the part where it also creates a felony offense for blocking vehicular traffic during a protest, that has been something that Republican lawmakers and law enforcement officers have pointed to as a problem, you know, especially in Durham, I believe a highway was blocked. We've also seen that in Charlotte with, you know, protests over the past years at various points. So I think in addition to the face mask part, that vehicular traffic section might give it some more juice, because that's been something they've really wanted to tighten penalties on.
Meanwhile, the UNC Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at UNC Chapel Hill is again calling for instructors to withhold students' final grades until administrators grant amnesty to suspended pro-Palestinian protesters. That would affect about 15 students. Has a demand like that been made in other protest situations to grant amnesty or to suspend grades?
From what I understand, that is a similar demand that's been made, particularly in the Ivy schools. I don't know about UNC Charlotte. I know that faculty signed a letter supporting the right of students to protest, but I don't think that demand is uncommon.
And about 800 faculty and staff members have also signed a petition urging Interim Chancellor Lee Roberts and Provost Chris Clemens to grant amnesty. Is that a significant number for that campus, 800 faculty? That's a lot of faculty, it sounds like.
I'm not sure
of the total number. You know, there's also a large number of adjunct faculty who... Right. You know, teach classes, and I don't know the breakdown between, you know, full-time staff, adjunct faculty, teaching assistants.
So the bottom line here is this is getting pretty messy here and around the country. So back to budgets for a moment. CMS pared back the budget it presented to Mecklenburg County Commission this week. The bottom line is an ask of $643 million. It's still $46 million more than CM asked for last year from the county. But the budget, as it was presented, got a surprising reaction from Commissioner Arthur Griffin, who used to chair the school board.
This is perhaps the worst budget that I've seen in 30 years for CMS as it relates to student achievement. This appears to be a people and things budget, but very light in terms of academic excellence.
And Commissioner Pat Cotham agreed with Griffin, saying parts of Superintendent Crystal Hill's presentation hit her in the gut. Hill, who went into that meeting, saying that she was very confident that County Commission would fully fund the district's reduced request, pushed back.
We were able to review what was working, what wasn't working. We were able to redirect funds. We were able to create efficiencies. And so because of that, our expansion request only reflects what we cannot do with our current operating budget.
And she also said that funds from other sources will go toward initiatives to increase academic achievement. Did that seem to satisfy Arthur Griffin or anyone else on the board who agrees with him that this is a budget and not a people budget?
The reaction was pretty mixed in the room. Both Commissioners Griffin and Cotham, I think, were, it's safe to say, were the most vocal critics. Both said they would have liked to see more funding for student achievement. Commissioner Griffin specifically brought up literacy amongst elementary age students and college and career readiness amongst high school students. Commissioner Cotham brought up some of the same issues, as well as rising wages for the district's lowest paid employees. That being said, some commissioners did seem more amenable. Commissioner Laura Meyer referred to the budget as wonderful and lauded the district for its recent standardized test performance. And then a lot of the rest of the commission said, you know, we're on board in theory. We just don't know that we're going to have the money. Commissioner Lee Altman posed the question, how are we going to make the math work? She said, you know, obviously the county likes public education. They want to fund public education, but they're also responsible for a lot of other services. And they also don't want to put an undue burden on homeowners through property taxes. So
am I imagining this? I mean, obviously, Arthur Griffin's not pleased with this because not enough money is being earmarked, in his opinion, toward academic excellence or academic achievement. But didn't they have a preliminary meeting on this with the county at which somebody from the county said, you're not asking for enough?
There was a joint meeting in February. I believe what you might be referring to might tie back to what Commissioner Cotham was saying about wages for the district's lowest paid employees. Both at that meeting and at this latest meeting, she said that she doesn't think that the raises in there are enough, that we need to be raising the wages for these workers because they're not making a livable wage based on the cost of living in Charlotte.
Yeah, and they were kind of talking in circles at this meeting, I thought, because Arthur Griffin was saying this is a, as he put it, people and things budget, not a student achievement budget. But then, you know, Crystal Hill, her counter was basically, yeah, well, who do you think makes the student achievements possible? We need to hire the best teachers and support staff and pay for the facilities we need. So, you know, this quote unquote people and things budget is what we need to increase your student achievement. You know, you can't just earmark money for student achievement. Someone has to be paid to go teach the students. But the bigger dynamic, again, comes back to these taxes, because Dina DiIorio earlier this year said the county can fund a $36 million increase in its budget without raising taxes. CMS alone is asking for more than that. And the county also has to cover raises for their own staff, all their other initiatives they want, their increased service costs. So, you know, Lee Altman saying, hey, we got to balance this, we got to make the math work, I think that could translate to some trims in how much CMS gets. But it's looking pretty likely that the county will have to hike taxes to pay for even part of what they want to fund.
Nick.
The ultimate thing to remember here is that because of a state law that was passed a few years ago, there's a mediated process for counties and school boards to go into when the school board wants more money than the county wants to give them. And it more or less ends with the school board getting the money they asked for. I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but, you know, typically the board is going into this with the upper hand. By the way, that law was authored by Charles Jeter, who now works for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools.
Some of the money that the CMS gets has to go, they're a pass-through organization to charter schools, and now with the expansion of opportunity scholarships, money is going directly to families so that they can use that money to fund their child's education in a private school. How will that, has anybody talked about how, given the demand for those scholarships, and I have 30 seconds here, how that might impact the public schools? Will they need as much money because that money is traveling with students who are leaving?
I think it's been a persistent talking point that this is another attack on funding public schools and that this will reduce the funding available for public schools. That's what Governor Cooper and his allies have said.
And will that increase the burden on counties to support public schools?
Well, that's something they've been saying for a long time, that the state doesn't pay enough. That comes up pretty much every budget cycle.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about CMS and some things that Nick Oxner has dealt with in the last couple of weeks. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor at WFAE News, Joe Bruno, reporter at WSOC-TV, host of their Political Beat program on Sunday mornings. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner is here. He's chief investigative reporter for WBTV. And for, gosh, months, probably more than a year or so, he has been dealing with the ongoing saga of sexual assaults and trying to root out a lot of information from CMS. You've been investigating and reporting on several incidents of alleged sexual assault at Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, and you say that records obtained by WBTV show leaders at CMS recorded significantly fewer instances of rapes and sexual assaults within a five-year span than other records would indicate. After a years-long request effort, they submitted evidently a one-page list of assaults, and your own research, you say, uncovered 167 incidences. How large is the discrepancy?
Well, the real discrepancy, Mike, is in 3 years, and that's important for the story, I think, that I've been trying to get this data since 2021. And the real discrepancy is that when I first asked for this data in 2021, the district sent me one page that just kind of gave me some raw numbers that we know themselves are incorrect because it said there was only one rape reported in all of CMS in a 10-year period. And I've talked to, you know, more students than that who said they reported and have documents to show they reported rapes at CMS schools. I've been trying to get a more detailed breakdown of specific reports of sexual violence by campus across CMS. Since 2021, the district has said repeatedly and importantly under oath that such records didn't exist. And the problem is this week, Mike, I published those records that I got from someone who isn't the school.
That person you're speaking to, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is CMS General Counsel Andre Mays, who submitted an affidavit under oath detailing the district's response to your requests. You're saying that she was not truthful in that affidavit?
That's correct. I mean, so she submitted an affidavit, as did two other employees, as part of a public records lawsuit. WBTV sued the school district, alleging they failed to properly produce a number of records, including the sexual assault data. And in Mays's affidavit, again, she's the general counsel for Charlotte Mecklenburg School. She's a sworn officer of the court. And in her affidavit, she said that zero records were withheld in response to my request for this data. Again, I have nearly 200 pages of records that would be exactly responsive. And we know there are more that would be responsive that I still don't have. And so there's simply no way to square what she wrote under oath in her affidavit.
You ran into her not too long ago, and this was on Channel 3 a couple of nights ago. You were at a board meeting. Prior to the board meeting starting, you stood on one side of a gate protecting the dais and tried to speak with her. She refused to talk to you, as many people do, by the way. And after minutes of prodding, she finally said something.
Does the public not deserve to see these records?
You have them.
Not from the board.
You have records. So if you have them, then provide them to the public.
Should the board have produced those records?
I don't even know what you're talking about, Mr. Auctioner, because you have not provided us with any information. You claim you have information. Write your story.
What was your reaction to that? Does it make sense? I mean, is she exaggerating? What's the deal here?
Well, she is exaggerating, saying she has no information because she had ignored two emails that I had previously sent her requesting an interview, because I'd prefer not to talk to public officials like I had to talk to Ms. Mays. But the deal is, Mike, we see yet again a Charlotte Mecklenburg's top official refusing to answer questions or be accountable in the handling of their sex assault. And by the way, while this was not an issue that went down when almost any member of the current Charlotte Mecklenburg Board of Education was on the board, right? This started 3 years ago. It now becomes incumbent on the current school board and Chairwoman Stephanie Sneed to do the right thing and produce the public record so that the public can know how often sexual violence is being reported on campuses.
Can you explain the reluctance to be transparent about this?
I simply cannot. I think Ms. Mays may say that, well, these are student records. And as you see in the records, we published what I got, and they can easily be redacted, which is required by law to redact the non-public parts and produce the public parts. That's what the law requires. That's what the public is entitled to know. And here we have yet another iteration of the board that is in office while these vital information about students reported being raped and sexually assaulted are being withheld. And for 3 years now, it has bewildered me why they won't be public about it. And I'm going to continue to push for this until they finally are honest and transparent with the public.
We just played a tiny clip of that encounter that you had with Andre Mays in the chamber at this, I guess it was a school board meeting, during which she told you to be careful. And you asked her several times what she meant by that, and she didn't answer. Do you know what she meant by that?
Well, she didn't answer, so I don't know. I still don't know. What I'm going to continue doing is reporting the truth and the facts
and continuing trying to get someone in charge of our city and county school system to be honest and transparent about how they handle reported sexual violence on their campuses.
Moving on, the legislature threw open the doors for opportunity scholarships, offering them to any student who wanted them, regardless of their parents' income, and these would be used to fund private school educations. It's called backpack funding, where the student gets the money and they use it as they choose. The demand was so great that the funds that they initially put up for it ran out, and now in the legislative short session, they are considering adding $300 million more to that. But even as that is being discussed, Governor Cooper, who has made his displeasure about these vouchers well known, is now calling for a moratorium. Is he wasting his breath?
Yes. I mean, look, the Republicans have supermajorities in both the House and the Senate. Those Republicans, Roy Cooper is a Democrat. We know where the Republican supermajorities land on this issue, and it's not on a moratorium.
He's made his displeasure, though, because he says it's giving money to rich people who don't need it at the expense of the public schools. And he outlined new legislation that would stop further expansion and add accountability measures for private schools accepting the money from these vouchers. And right now, evidently, there are very few restrictions, if any, on private schools. And in fact, he would like this legislation to require students to take standardized tests for their grades, which would put them on a level playing field with the public schools. We would know how they were performing with public money through these private scholarship funds. Is that an unreasonable request for taxpayer money?
Well, I think education reporter Ann Doss Helms has highlighted some of the problems with some of these private schools that accept vouchers. They can be, you know, some of them are well established. Some of them might be fly-by-night organizations, and there's really no way to tell how students are doing. So the core of the voucher argument, one is that parents should be able to send their kids where they want, parental choice. The second is it's a way out of underperforming public schools. I think if you don't know that the students are going to a better school, that, you know, are that they're not just going to a private school that is under-resourced, then yeah, that's a reasonable thing to ask for. You know, say what you will about public schools, there is a fantastic amount of data, and, you know, every metric you could think about that is available there. So I think this request, you know, if it were separate on its own, maybe it would have a little more momentum. But, you know, being paired with this moratorium, I don't think is going to go anywhere.
And those who are opposed to this idea of opportunity scholarships are opposed in part because this is taxpayer money going to private schools that are that do not have the same academic accountability requirements that public schools have traditionally had. But also it's taxpayer money going to private schools who can choose to admit or not admit certain people based on their own criteria, which is their right. But then you run up against something like we encountered this week. 10 years ago, just a few years after winning Teacher of the Year, Charlotte Catholic High School fired Lonnie Billard after learning that about his same-sex partner, and he sued. And this week, a federal appeals court found that the school was within its rights to fire him, which overturned a lower court ruling. What was their reasoning?
So the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Lonnie Billard was in, as a teacher at Charlotte Catholic, was in a ministerial position. There's an exception in the laws forbidding discrimination based on sex and sexuality and other factors that allows religious institutions to discriminate against people in ministerial positions if it conforms to their beliefs. So, for example, you know, you wouldn't have a mosque forced to hire a gay imam if they didn't want to. What the Fourth Circuit did here is say, in this context, a teacher at a Catholic school is in a ministerial position, even though, you know, he's not a Catholic minister or teaching religious classes.
Which is the right of that school, and I guess any school to do, but the man they fired pays taxes, and his tax money with these opportunity scholarships would now be used to fund a school that fired him, and that's one of the problems with this. We had Charlotte area Republican State Senator Vicki Sawyer on this program this week to talk about the I-77 toll lanes south of Uptown, and she sounded a little bit out of step with some of her colleagues in Raleigh when it comes to that project, since she's from here. She seems to really understand our needs, and she would go on later in the week, Mary, to make news by saying there's an opportunity for the Red Line commuter train to come to fruition. She chairs the State Senate Transportation Committee. So what else did she say?
Yeah, Senator Sawyer made these comments on the Under the Dome podcast, which is produced by our sister paper in Raleigh, the News and Observer. And she said exactly what you said, that there is opportunity to make the Red Line happen in the wake of these recent public meetings that CATS has held to update the design for the rail line, and also potential movement from Norfolk Southern to grant long-awaited access to tracks that are really vital to actually make this happen. She said that she is broadly speaking in favor of commuter rail. She referenced how much money her family is spending monthly on tolls and said they would welcome a transit alternative.
Yeah. She referenced it on this program, $300 a month.
Yes, she told us the same thing. Yeah, and at the same time, she said she's still unsure about backing this project, specifically the Red Line, because of questions about how to pay for it. She, like many North Mecklenburg residents and leaders, has said that the community feels very scorned by past inaction from CATS on progress for the Red Line, saying that they've been paying higher taxes to help make this happen since the late 90s under the current interlocal transit agreement and seen no progress. So they're very hesitant, and lawmakers in Raleigh are very hesitant to allow Charlotte to put a sales tax measure on the ballot to get even more money, which Charlotte has said is vital to making the Red Line happen. So,
and this is where she intersects with some of her Raleigh cohorts, because as you know, Senate and House leaders have both said that our transportation plan is too rail-centric and doesn't feature enough emphasis on roads. And she said she absolutely supports, that's her word, absolutely supports the idea of the Red Line, but she's iffy on a tax increase that would support it. And without that, it isn't going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. And she said, you know, it's all rooted in the fact that she feels like it's, you know, like she and her fellow legislators and the community feel like, why should we give you more tax money to make this happen when we did that before and you failed to make the project happen?
So very quickly, because we are running very short on time, the voter ID law that may determine the fate of voter ID in North Carolina and perhaps elsewhere in the country started in Winston-Salem this week. The one side, the NAACP, arguing that it unfairly impacts Black and Latino voters ahead of this fall's election. The state insists that it increases voter confidence in election integrity. How would you characterize the first week of this trial, Eli?
You know, I think we've seen a lot of the same arguments that we've seen from these groups. It's worth remembering this is a case that started, I believe, 5 years ago. So it was delayed for a while, but it's finally before a judge for a trial now. We don't really have new evidence. We have a lot of the same arguments being made. And I think it comes down to whether you believe there is a disparate impact or not.
Joe, there's a GOP runoff next Tuesday in the race to be a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor between Hal Weatherman and Jim O'Neill. Mr. Weatherman was the former chief of staff to the former lieutenant governor, Dan Forrest. After that, he took a job that he says he's not ashamed of, working for Congressman Madison Cawthorn. But the other candidate is Jim O'Neill. And you spoke to Jim O'Neill for your Sunday show. He's the district attorney of Forsyth County, who, when you spoke with him, brought up a political ad controversy from when he ran for attorney general in 2020 against the current occupant of that office, Josh Stein, who is now running for governor. He lost that race by 13,000 votes. He blames that ad for that loss.
It was clear from the polling going in that Josh Stein was in trouble. He was going to lose. And so he created a fake story that the district attorneys were actually in charge of the rape kits. It was totally made up. It was a fraud. DAs are not in charge of those. He controls the lab. He sets the parameters under which you can send a rape kit in. And so all the DAs were complying with his rules, and he turned it around and made it so that Jim O'Neill was responsible for these rape kits, a total fabricated lie. We had law firm reach out to him and tell him he needed to cease and desist. He refused, of course, because his only goal was to win.
Is this something that is remembered by voters, and will it play a role at all in this contest?
You know, if it happened last week, I don't know if voters would remember it little because of everything that happens nowadays, water off a fire hydrant. But, you know, and this also isn't something that he loses sleep over, but I think it's part of his story. You know, he really did come so close to winning that attorney general race, and now he's in overtime with the lieutenant governor race. It's the most interesting race on the ballot coming up on Tuesday now that the 13th district seems settled. We'll see how it shakes out.
And by that, he's also casting aspersions on the man running for governor on the Democratic ticket. Very quickly, Joe, I know you want to talk about this. The Hornets have a new coach. Who is he? Quickly.
Charles Lee, assistant coach from the Celtics.
Good choice.
Safe choice,
which is exactly what Scott Fowler said. Joe Bruno, Nick Oxner, Mary Ramsey, Eli Portillo, thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.